All rise. Oyez, oyez, oyez. The United States Court of Appeals for Veterans Claims is now in session. The Honorable Lawrence Hagel presiding. All who have business before this court are on ear, and you shall be heard. God bless the United States and this honorable court. You may be seated.
Good morning. I understand a couple of things here. I've been informed that Mrs. Jernigan is here. Is that correct?
Yes, sir.
Mrs. Jernigan, if you would like, you're welcome to come and sit next to your counsel. Thank you very much for coming. We don't get an opportunity to see many parents here. It's nice to see someone in person. Mr. Quinn, I want to thank you for informing the clerk and the court of your call and the fact you're chewing gum, so we wouldn't consider that somehow disrespectful to the court. So thank you very much for that. Okay. Now let's call the case. The case here today is the United, Bethsaida, is that correct?
Bethsaida.
Thank you very much. Bethsaida Jernigan versus the Secretary of Veterans Affairs, Eric Shinseki. The docket number is 101226. Who will speak for Mrs. Jernigan?
David Lowenstein, Your Honor.
And who will speak for the Secretary?
I'm Mark Vitich. I'm accompanied today by David Quinn, Deputy Assistant General Counsel of the Department of Veterans Affairs.
Thank you very much. Okay, Mr. Lowenstein.
Thank you. If I may reserve 10 minutes for rebuttal.
Okay, make it so.
Again, my name is David Lowenstein. I represent the appellant, Bethsaida Jernigan. The issue in this case is, what is the proper effective date? What counts as an application for benefits? Filing a formal application is necessary to get paid, but it does not necessarily set the effective date. By law, the effective date, based on Section 5110A, is the date of receipt of application. In Section 3.400B2, VA also recognizes the effective date based on the date of receipt of the claim.
Mr. Lowenstein, let me just cut to the chase. I like to get questions answered that I have an interest in. Why did your client wait for 6 years? Do you know? I've combed the record. I don't see an answer to that question.
That answer is unknown.
Unknown.
I don't have an answer as to why it was delayed by 6 years, but for our purposes, it doesn't matter as far as setting the effective date.
What is the harm to the VA from your standpoint, for the delay? What harm is caused by processing an effective date at the time of the initial informal claim?
Well, the effective date is a date based on the informal claim that was filed in 1995.
That's your position, I
That's
understand.
Our position. Right. So the fact that she filed a formal application 6 years later in 2001, that is the date that payment, or the award of benefits and payment, can be made. And there's a distinction between the date of payment and the award and the effective date. It's our position that
I don't quite understand that. Could you explain that?
Sure.
And then you finish answering Judge Davis's question, but I'd like to follow your answer.
Absolutely. It's our position that the effective date that's assigned, based on 5110A, 3.400, those are the effective date statute and regulations. And
I think you said, if I remember correctly, the date of award is different than the date of payment. And I don't understand how that relates to the informal claim versus the formal claim?
Your Honor, if I said that, I think I misspoke. There's not a difference between...
So, I'm sorry, just to clarify. So, your position is that the date that she filed her initial claim should be the informal claim, should be the effective date for both receiving payments back to that date and saying that that's the effective date of the claim for whatever purposes that may matter, such as DIC or something?
Yes.
Okay, so, got it.
The formal application is a requirement that the Secretary has authorized it. Basically, all the information they want contained on a document, the 21-526, that's the application, the formal application. And that was filed in 2001. But there's nothing in the statute, 5110 and the corresponding regulation, that has to do with the date of receipt of a claim as far as setting the effective date. And claim and application, which are used in the statute and regulation, has been defined by the Secretary. Under 3.1P, specifically, the Secretary has defined claim and application as a formal or informal claim. And it's our position that her filing, Ms. Jernigan's filing the informal claim, that has been defined by the Secretary as a claim. And the effective date is based on the date of receipt of the application or the claim.
Let us assume that the date that she files her informal claim is a date of claim. But if her informal claim, or be it a formal claim, is incomplete of information that the Secretary needs, then why don't we look to Section 5103 that at the time stated that if a claimant's application for benefits under the laws administered by the Secretary is incomplete, the Secretary shall notify the claimant of the evidence necessary if it's not received within 1 year from the date of such notification, no benefits may be paid. So I don't understand why 5103 doesn't control this situation.
Respectfully, 5103A is not an effective date statute. There's an effective date statute specifically in play here, and that's 5110A.
Then what does 5103 do?
5103A has to do with the date of application. There's not a effective date. The implication by 5103A is that if one does not file a formal application within 1 year, then the informal date, the effective date, can't go back to the date of the informal claim. But that's implied. The corresponding regulation 3.155A mirrors the language in 5103.
Well, if 5103 is unclear or is implied, then why doesn't the regulation fill that gap?
Well, the regulation, there are a number of regulations in play that define what an effective date is based on. That's based on a claim or an application. There's nothing provided in 5103A that existed back in 1995 that explained what would happen if a formal application was not filed as far as the effective date is concerned.
Well, if we look to Fleshman, it requires a applicant to sign the certification sections and the waiver portion in order to be an effective application. An informal claim cannot have those attributes. So per se, an informal claim would be an incomplete application.
I would agree with that, Your Honor. We would respectfully submit that the informal claim contained the necessary information. It contained, in Fleshman, that dealt with an actual formal application. And the court considered that formal application to be incomplete. The veteran was notified what was missing in that case, why it was incomplete, and that had to do with the signature. What was filed on the 1995 claim, she signed it. It was on a VA form. Admittedly, it was not a 21-526, but it was on an actual VA form. She signed it. There is language similar to the waiver or the actual information contained on a 526. It's not as complete, but she did sign it. There's information about her name, the disabilities she was seeking benefits for, her mailing address, She submitted service medical records which discuss or explain her the branch of service and also discuss the conditions that she had during service. So it contained all the necessary information. And the 526, the actual formal application.
Did she have private medical treatment?
I'm sorry?
Did she have private medical treatment?
This is dated, she filed the claim 3 months or 2 months following service. So the medical records that she submitted were service medical records, not private medical records.
Did she receive or go to a private doctor before she filed this application?
Not in the record. No.
Sorry?
No. The medical records she submitted were all service medical records.
But isn't that part of the 5126 or 46? In other words, one of the questions on that document is list all of the medical people that you've been to, all the doctors that you've been to, correct?
I believe that is one of the questions answered.
So, and there's a waiver on that, correct?
Correct.
In other words, saying, I give my authority for you to go and get some practice.
Correct.
So if that's filled in or not filled in, is an important fact for the secretary to know, is it not?
It's important if it's relevant. We would submit that that information was not relevant to her claim. It may be relevant if she did seek private treatment, and therefore VA had an obligation to go out and get those records. But where it wasn't relevant to her claim, she had submitted the actual medical records in support of her claim.
She had submitted VA
records. Military records.
Right.
Correct. And again, this is within 2-3 months of her actually leaving service.
But the VA has the right to know, and it's important to the claim. It's not irrelevant to the claim whether she went to see private medical treatment or did not, because those medical records or the absence of those records would be relevant to the analysis of the records that were received. For example, if she went to a private doctor and a private doctor gave an opinion that was in some way opposite to the claim that she made, her spine was fine. Wouldn't that be relevant and important for the VA to know in adjudicating her claim?
Your Honor, that would be relevant, but
so,
in this case...
Go ahead, I'm sorry. Go ahead.
That would be relevant if it were pertinent to the claim and what information was put forward or not put forward. In this case, that's not a relevant question. And in 51, it's not a relevant... Your question is relevant. The fact that she didn't submit that information is irrelevant to her claim. The 526, the formal application, actually does not need to have all the information contained. VA's manual actually says that in order for there to be a substantially complete application, it needs to contain certain information. And all that information was contained in the informal claim.
So your position is that the informal claim, which is VA Form 214138 and the record at 2186, is really a claim. And it's not incomplete. Is that your position?
Correct. And the Secretary has defined claim under 3.1p as a formal or informal claim. And it contains the, yes, so to answer your question, it is a claim.
And as I look at that form that Ms. Jernigan filled out, it has her name, it has her Social Security number, and it basically says the veteran has back, spinal, wrist, arm, in parentheses, left, both shoulders, dash, stomach upset, in parentheses, ulcer, question mark. Please request CP exam plus reevaluation of S/C disabilities. Thank you. Please find a record enclosed. That is the claim.
Yes. And that should set the effective date based on the language in 5110A and the Secretary's implementing regulation 3.400.
So she needed, from your perspective, she needn't do anything else other than wait for the claim to be processed.
Correct. In this case, there was nothing else that needed to be done. has she been informed of specific information or additional evidence that needed to be considered? That's a different matter.
She did receive notice, right?
She received notice of her informal claim.
Okay, and she, and that notice indicated that if she wanted to submit something else, she could. Is that correct?
Right. There is nothing mandatory in the August 1995 letter, and that's at record 2185. Right. There's nothing contained in that notice letter that informed her that the accompanying 526 form was necessary to her claim. Nothing about the time frame in which she or the secretary needed to be submitted. It's absent any of that information.
I'd like to turn to this question of notice of the one-year time limit. Let's just assume, for argument's sake, that this court determines that VA had no obligation to give notice of the consequences of not filing within a year. I know you argued that the notice that she did receive was potentially misleading or confusing. Could the fact that, let's say we agreed that it was misleading or confusing, could that somehow give rise to a duty where we had found none had existed?
If I understand your question correctly, if I can rephrase, and if the time frame did not exist?
No. We found that VA was under no obligation to give notice of the consequences of failing to meet the time limit. And then if we agreed that the notice that they did give was misleading, does the fact that it's misleading somehow give rise to a duty or create some sort of violation, even though they don't have a duty in the first place to give notice?
I would submit yes. I mean, if there's no obligation to give notice, and assuming the one-year requirement actually is a one-year requirement, then yes, if there's misleading information, and it basically, the information given to the veteran tells her to do something or not do something, that is prejudicial to the veteran. And that's similar in other circumstances where you have notice of appellate rights, for instance, where the notice rights and the time frame in which to submit an appeal is in the statute or it's in the regulation. It's documented, but VA gives notice and explains what the appellate rights are. And if those appellate rights are not given to the veteran, this court has found that that is prejudicial.
I believe there's a statutory requirement to provide appellate rights, is there not?
There is a statutory requirement. But if the information is misleading, that's problematic as well. So there's two problems here. One, it's required by statute, but the other problem is the VA gives misleading information. That's problematic as well. In the context of new material evidence, in this court's decision in Kent, if new material evidence, if the information provided to the veteran, again, is misleading or confusing and does not give the proper information about what is new and what's material and relating back to the original claim, the court has found that that notice is inadequate and it sends the case back. So here we have a situation where Ms. Jordan-Gidden was provided notice. There is a notice letter, but it does not provide any of the information to inform her of what is necessary and when it's required to be submitted.
Can we find the notice misleading in the first instance? Because the board didn't address that question.
That raises an interesting question. I think that because the board found that the effective date is based on the date of the formal application, they made a finding. And this case encompasses what is the proper effective date. So I don't think it's necessarily binding that the board, or required that the board address it in the first instance. I think this court, under its review of all the evidence, and that evidence was before the board, I believe this court can consider it in the first instance.
Could we, I'm sorry, just one more. Could we award a effective date back to 1995, or would we need to remand if we agreed with all your arguments so that the VA could determine whether entitlement was established based on, you know, the CALUSA elements at that time?
I think this court can actually find the effective date The board made a finding that the proper effective date is 2001. I think this court can easily find, based on the existing statutes and regulations and the definitions the Secretary has provided, that the effective date is based on the claim that was filed in 1995.
Aren't there factual questions that would need to be addressed in the first instance?
I don't believe that to be the case. If this court did find that there are factual matters that the board did not consider outright and it's not within the framework here, then yes, that may be an appropriate remedy. But I believe that this court does have the authority to find that based on the statute and regulations that the board relied on, that it was clearly erroneous that the actual standard should be based on the date of the claim filed in 1995.
I have two questions to ask. Let me see if I can remember that. The first is, you talked about the analogy to notice, right? Intent, correct?
Yes.
Well, and you're claiming that the letter that the VA sent in response to what you will call here an informal claim or a formal claim asked for more information, correct? It asks for more information. It says, fill out this form and give us more information, correct?
Well, it just says, fill out the actual language.
Well, it
doesn't specify what information is lacking other than here's an attached form.
Fill it out.
Fill it out. Okay. It doesn't say that there's...
Doesn't that identify the information that they would like to have?
Well, it doesn't mean that any... Respectfully, it doesn't mean that any information is not already in the informal claim or formal claim that's been submitted. It just says, we require the information to be filled out on a form, basically to obtain all the information on one form, but that's all that we know. There's no indication that anything specifically was not already provided in the attached medical records and the actual informal claim that she filed.
Okay. Second question. Isn't the VA entitled to at some point say that, look, the claimant has abandoned the claim. We have tried to communicate with the claimant. The claimant hasn't responded to our requests. Isn't there some time when the VA is entitled to say, hey, we're closing this out? And if the individual really wants their benefits, they'll come back and apply again.
But there's nothing in 3.155A or any other regulation specifically in this circumstance saying what would happen if you don't submit the claim. Because I started off with the distinction between the effective date and payment. We believe that the payment cannot be made until the formal application is filed. But that doesn't mean that the claim is abandoned if the formal application is not filed.
Saying the second document is a formal application and this is...
As the Secretary has defined it, yes. We don't believe that there's anything wrong with requiring an actual formal application. We believe that's within the Secretary's right to do that, and the statute allows for the Secretary to do that. But that doesn't mean that the effective date is based only on when the formal application is filed. Because the statute and regulations talk about the claim and the application, and the Secretary has defined that as being an informal claim. The actual date, the effective date, is based on the date that she first filed her informal claim.
Okay, thank you.
So if 214138, the quote, informal claim, is in fact formal, or contains all the indicia of a formal claim, what prompted Ms. Jernigan to submit the formal paperwork claim 6 years later?
Again, I'm sorry I don't have an answer that addresses that, but the...
I'm sorry you don't do.
But we would submit that the fact that she submitted it years later does not minimize the importance of when the effective date is. Because she first filed her claim, which again has been defined as an informal claim. So the only issue is, could payment be made at the time she filed her first claim, the original claim in 1995? And the answer is no. VA could not have awarded benefits and paid her benefits at that time. Because she filed it in 2001, and VA ultimately a year later granted service connection based on the same conditions, that is when payment and the award of benefits were made, and properly so. But the effective date should have been back to the date of receipt of the claim or application.
I see your time is up.
Thank you.
If you need more time, you will have that.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the Court. Again, I'm Mark Vichich. I'm appearing on behalf of the Secretary today. This Court should affirm the Board's decision for two reasons. First, because the statute governing incomplete applications, as in effect in 1995, prohibits the Secretary from assigning an earlier effective date in this case. And second, because the appellant abandoned her claims pursuant to the Secretary's Regulation 3.158A. Now, to be very clear, the Secretary does not dispute that the appellant filed a claim in July of 1995. However, whether the Secretary is legally allowed to pay benefits based upon that claim depends upon whether it is formal or informal. The distinction is important because an informal claim is not a claim in the form prescribed by the Secretary. A claim that is not in the form prescribed by the Secretary is an incomplete application for benefits, and the Secretary is prohibited from paying benefits by reason of an incomplete application for benefits.
How is the Secretary prohibited?
Because 5103A states that upon receipt of an incomplete application, that the application form with the instructions will be provided, and that no benefits will be paid.
Where does it say?
5103A, Your Honor, says. If such evidence is not received within 1 year of the date of such notification, no benefits may be paid or furnished.
There's a difference between may and will, isn't there? I think it's important that when you're talking to the court, you're very clear about important provisions of the statute. Now, isn't there a difference between may and will?
Yes, Your Honor, but I believe that the language "no benefits may be paid" means that the Secretary may not pay benefits, and that is what the Secretary interprets as a prohibition of paying benefits based upon an incomplete application that has not become complete within 1 year.
Okay, well, tell me why that's not the word "may" is not discretionary.
Because of the word "not," Your Honor, because the Secretary may not pay benefits. Additionally, the parties agree that when the VA received the claim in July of 1995, that it promptly provided the appellant with the appropriate application form with instructions to return it to the VA. Because she did not do so until more than 6 years later, 5103 says that the Secretary may not pay benefits based upon that claim.
Can I stop you again?
Yes, Your Honor.
Let's go back to your statement before the Secretary may pay benefits. Now, would you say that again so I can get that? Go ahead.
I believe what I said, Your Honor, is that when the Secretary provided the notice, because he did not, and the application form, because he did not receive a substantially complete form within 1 year of that notice,
Let me ask you a question.
Yes, Your Honor.
This notice that you are talking about is the letter, I take it, the August 95 letter?
Page 2185 of the record, yes, Your Honor.
Now, where does it say that Mrs. Jernigan must send that form back?
Well, Your Honor, it says that the enclosed form should be completed and returned so that for...
Excuse me?
Yes.
The enclosed form, can skip out over that next word. What's the next word?
Is it should be completed and returned.
Should.
Yes.
Right. Now, does that say, that didn't say must, does it?
No, but there's the second. This is where the Supreme Court's rule in Merrill applies, because the Secretary doesn't have an obligation to provide notice of the time frame or the effects of not returning the form. And that's what this court held in Morris, that the appellant is deemed to have knowledge of the relevant statutory and regulatory scheme unless there's an affirmative notice obligation. And here the Secretary satisfied the affirmative notice obligation when it provided the form.
But the Secretary's regulation says if an informal claim, which is what you say that the initial communication was.
Correct. Correct.
If the informal claim is made, then the Secretary, I'm guessing now, must send the claimant, the putative claimant, the form provided by the Secretary.
An application will be forwarded to the claimant for execution, yes.
Okay. And so the Secretary's placed on himself the obligation to send this form to the individual for, I would assume, well, you can explain to me if I'm wrong, in order that the putative claimant has the ability to file a formal claim. And if that happens, because the individual has expressed an intent to file that claim, the Secretary will in fact make the effective date of that claim when the original communication was made. Correct?
So long as the formal claim is received
That's
within
correct.
1 year, yes.
But if the Secretary, in the notification, doesn't say you must send this back in order, must, in order for us to process your claim. How does that satisfy the Secretary's really complete obligation to let the individual know that this has to be done?
With 3.158A, the abandonment provision is relevant here, because you know that's where the Secretary has a right to consider a claim to be abandoned that's not completed within 1 year. So I believe, Your Honor, that's where the answer to the question comes. Even if there's no affirmative duty to notify the claimant as to what will happen, whether it's mandatory or not mandatory, as long as the Secretary requests some action on behalf of the claimant has 1 year to respond to that request. And so the abandonment provision, which this court held in Morris, was consistent with the incomplete application statute, would provide the answer here.
Well, there's another issue similar to this that concerns me, and that is the statement that you ignore any other paragraph on this form that is not checked. And therefore, do you not think it's reasonable for somebody to believe, okay, I filed my claim, now I got to file this other stuff that they sent me?
Well,
do you think that's a reasonable assumption?
Well, what the important point here to remember is that the appellant claimed in her notice of disagreement in her VA Form 9 that she never actually received this notice. And that's why this court's decision in Edwards is relevant here, because even if this is misleading, which the Secretary does not concede, if there's no detrimental reliance, there can be no fair process violation. So even if it is misleading, without having anything to point to in the record that she relied on it to her detriment, saying that I thought I had more than 1 year, or I was never instructed of the importance of this, then the actual content of the letter doesn't become as important in this case. Again, what is important is that the Secretary provided the appropriate application forms, which the appellant concedes, and instructed her to fill those forms out.
and that satisfied the notice obligation that the secretary had. Additionally, it's also looking at the notice itself. It's divided into two parts, one and two. The first part talks about establishing entitlement, whereas two refers to the suspension of benefits that are already being paid. So, checking box one, subpart A, the reasonable reading, Your Honor, would be that subpart one applies as well. But again, even if that is considered misleading, there is the lack of actual reliance to her detriment.
Well, she hasn't argued that she did not receive the document before this court. Instead, she argued that the notice was misleading. So I'd kind of like to pursue that line of inquiry for a moment. I'll ask you a similar question to what I asked the appellant's counsel, which was, even if we agree that VA doesn't have a duty to tell her she had to file it within 1 year, if I'm not going to quibble with you, but I think since there's a block next to the one and then there's a block next to the 1A, I can't impute the one comments onto 1A. So let's just say it's misleading for the sake of argument. When VA tells them wrong information, doesn't that somehow create an obligation or make that to the agency's peril, kind of an Irwin equitable tolling kind of argument that, yes, she's charged with having knowledge, but if the agency tells her something wrong and confuses her, misleads her, that somehow affects the agency's position?
I would have two responses, Your Honor. First is I would bring up Edwards again, as what I brought up earlier, that there still needs to be, this court held that the appellant needed to point to something to demonstrate detrimental reliance, and that's just not in existence here. So even if this could be interpreted to be misleading without any detrimental reliance, then the misleading content would not matter. Additionally, I would point to the Supreme Court's decision or the Federal Circuit's decision in OPM regarding the prohibition of payment of benefits that are not statutorily authorized. And based on the Secretary's reading of the old version of 5103A, that benefits may not be paid. No benefits may not be paid by reason of the application, then that would prohibit this. Then that would mean, Your Honor, that equitable tolling would not apply.
Well, in the case of Cirillo, the court found that, or Cervello, that the notice wasn't received by the appellant, or the agency didn't potentially send it, so it wouldn't start the 1 year period. I'm not clear how OPM would have.
Well, in that case, if the notice were not sent, then the 1 year period would not apply. That's correct, Your Honor. But here again, the parties agreed that the notice was sent to the correct address of record. The board found as fact that the presumption of regularity applies, and appellant agrees, page 1, 3, 12, and 14 of her brief, that that's the correct factual premise. So the 1 year period did start ticking when that notice was sent.
So, counsel, I assume that your position on the Pelea case would be that, again, because there's no detrimental reliance, that that case would be inapposite as well. Are you familiar with Pelea?
I am not, Your Honor, but no, without detrimental reliance, it would not make a difference. Yeah.
The defective notice.
Correct. Again, even presuming it were somehow deficient. Again, the Supreme Court's rule in Merrill would apply here because there was no notice obligation to provide notice of the 1 year time limit. However, to the extent that this could be interpreted as misleading because there's nothing suggesting that the appellant waited 6 years because of that notice, then this court's decision at Edwards would control.
Did you make that argument in your brief?
No, Your Honor. The arguments raised, I did The secretary did cite to Edwards in a Rule 30B notice filed with this court several weeks ago. The secretary stands by the arguments in the briefs regarding this issue, and that would be the Merrill rule applies. The notice is not misleading. And again, comparing it, say, to Cushman, where there was a due process violation based upon the failure to provide the appellant with an unfair hearing, would be factually distinguishable here. Appellant did have two hearings. She has not alleged that those were inadequate in some way. There's simply no lack of transparency in the process that would happen here, whereas, you know, in Cushman there was an altered document. VA had altered a document, and that prevented the appellant from having a fair hearing based upon an adequate record. And that's not, this is just a matter of checking boxes and providing notice, and that's not factually distinguishable from Cushman in that respect. So,
well, if you take the position in Cushman that the agency did something wrong that resulted in harm to the appellant's ability to prosecute their claim, is this really that different? The agency didn't explain to her what would happen if she didn't file it within a year, and they didn't potentially confused her that she didn't have to file it within a year, which is worse, and that impeded her ability to assist and prosecute her claim.
Well, again, two responses. First, yes, the secretary would argue that this is very distinguishable from Cushman. The conduct in Cushman was not even comparable. Again, this is just a matter of checking boxes and an administrative task, and not any.
So there has to be some sort of intent or malfeasance.
There would need to be willful intent or malfeasance. Yes, and again, the secretary would rely on the fact that we don't have actual reliance in this case.
Hasn't the Supreme Court found in other contexts, for example, cited in Judge Kramer's concurrence in Morris, in Social Security case law, where Social Security applicant got inadequate or confusing or lacking notice to be a due process violation?
It would be a fact-specific determination, Your Honor. It would the Secretary's position is that the notice in this case does not rise to that level. But again, the secretary would hang his hat, so to speak, on the fact that there's no reliance, even presuming that this was so egregiously misleading as to result in a due process violation.
I'd like to probe a little bit on your reliance on Morris and Merrill. In Morris, the a veteran was told about the one-year time limit to file the formal claim. So in that instance, perhaps Merrill makes lots of sense. And in this case, Ms. Jernigan was not told of that one-year time limit. So does that make Morris distinguishable from this case?
Well, first, the reliance on Morris in this case was for the abandonment provisions, which does not include a notice element. So long as the secretary requests additional information or evidence, there's the one-year time period applies, and the secretary is not required to notify the claimant of that one-year period.
Well, Morris did discuss in its part of its case that it relied on Merrill that the appellant got good notice.
A notice of the one-year time period to complete the application.
Yes, that's what I'm speaking of.
Yes, but 3.158A... which the court held was consistent with that the statute, which at the time was 3003, which is now for this case 5103A, held that the abandonment provision was consistent with that statute, and that does not have a time period. And again, we're looking at the notice itself, and I understand that you don't agree, Your Honor, but this
we don't know that yet.
Okay, but again, the secretary would just. You said earlier that I believe you were not totally convinced yet, at least that subpart A means that one applies, but one does say subpart one in this letter says that it must be received by VA within 1 year of the date. So the secretary would rely that he did would argue that he did provide notice of the 1 year time period. But in any event, he was not required to provide notice of the one-year time period, so failure to do so would not have been a violation anyway. Thank you.
Thank you. I'd like to respond to the actual notice that was allegedly given to Mr. Erdingen. There is reference throughout the letter itself of should and must. And obviously when the Secretary uses those terms, they mean different things, especially when they're contained in the same document. And the actual line that was checked, and the only line that was checked, was that the enclosed form should be completed and returned to this office so that further action may be taken. There's no indication, and a reasonable person reading this letter would not necessarily believe that it's required to be submitted with any time frame, or that VA wouldn't act on her claim absent the submission of the application. And moreover, the actual...
Now, wait, let me stop you there. Why do you say it's not reasonable for her to think that the VA would not act on her application when it says, send us more things so that we may take further action on your claim? Doesn't that imply that, hey, if we don't get these things in a reasonable amount of time, then we're going to consider your claim abandoned?
Well, there's no indication about even a reasonable amount of time. It just says, please, you should complete this form. There's an implication that VA may or may not act on it without the information.
Well, what if they do?
If they act on it without the formal application or with the formal application?
Without the formal application.
Without the formal application, then that actually supports our claim that the effective date would most certainly be based on the informal claim that she filed originally.
Well, now, I'm going to make your position here clear in my mind. I thought earlier you said that the initial communication with the VA had all the information necessary for a formal claim. Therefore, the VA should have acted on it as if it were a formal claim and nothing else had to be submitted.
You can't
have it both ways, it seems to me. If I understood you correctly.
I think the answer to your question is that the formal application that VA requires is set up, designed so all the information can be contained within one document. There's no other reason for the formal application as the parameters...
There's no reason for the formal application to be filed?
Well, there's a reason. The Secretary has designed that to be the case.
Well, doesn't the statute say that no application will be considered unless it is filed on a form provided designated by the Secretary?
Right. And
so it seems to me it is pretty important if the form is filled out or not.
It is important, it's relevant, and it's required, but that doesn't set the effective date. Because in this case, she did file the formal application in 2001.
Right.
And based on that formal application, award of benefits were made and payment was made as well.
But she didn't file the formal application within a year, which is also a regulation of the Secretary. It says, tell you what, even assuming everything you said, the Secretary wouldn't have any authority to pay more than 1 year retroactive to the time that she filed the formal claim. Isn't that a fair interpretation, too?
That's a fair interpretation, but it's not consistent with the other regulations that are relevant here. And that includes 3.400, 3.1, and even 3.160, which defines original claim. So when you have other regulations that actually speak to what the definition of what a claim and application are and how that affects an effective date, those regulations need to all gel. They need to all work together. and where 3.155 doesn't even talk about the ramifications of not filing the formal claim within 1 year. And you have effective dates that actually answer that question, as defined by the Secretary. Those are controlling.
Counsel, was your client harmed or prejudiced in any way by the defective notice, if
yes.
It's defective?
Yes, Your Honor.
How? Did she rely on it to wait for 6 years?
That's certainly the likely possibility, because the notice that was
but
given...
But you told me before you didn't know why she waited for six years.
It's one possibility. I don't know the answer to your question, but the notice provided, because it was deficient and misleading, it was detrimental. It was prejudicial, because there's
if
no...
She relied on it.
She relied on it.
She
but
did.
She relied on the notice that was deficient.
Is it your position now that she received the notice?
I still, and that wasn't a issue that was raised in the briefs, and it's not contested. So in other words...
So you're agreeing that she received it?
Yes, it's not before, it's not an argument that we made to the court that she did not receive notice.
If, in fact, do you dispute the fact that detrimental reliance would be required in order for us to accept your position that this is defective notice?
It's one factor, but it's not the only factor.
Okay. Who has the responsibility to prove prejudice in such a situation?
It's the appellant's burden.
Okay. Then how? Tell me how you're going to prove prejudice if you don't know why the appellant waited 6 years to file this form. If you don't know the answer to that question, you can't allege it, and Mrs. Jernigan can't prove it, then how do we find prejudice in the even if we assume that this is defective in some fashion?
Because the reliance on this letter, looking at the letter...
Excuse me, you told us before that you didn't know if there was reliance.
What I'm saying is the information that was provided indicates a reasonable person looking at this letter, there's nothing required. It's actually discretionary in terms of whether this form needs to be submitted and when it needs to be submitted. That the block is not checked, and it specifically says ignore any paragraph not checked.
Granted all that, counsel, but I mean the bottom line here is that she waited for a reason. I mean, you know, and the record apparently is absent of any indication as to why Ms. Jernigan waited for 6 years. She's sitting in front of us. She can't tell us why she waited for 6 years. It's not part of the record. I think this has gotten ludicrous in some ways. And it bothers the hell out of me that we don't know why she waited for 6 years, yet she didn't rely on the notice you're telling us, or she did, but you really don't know.
Well, I understand your frustration, Your Honor.
I'm glad you do.
I do, but I would submit that we can look to the actual language in 5110A and 3.400B2, which actually define when an effective date should be assigned, and that's based on the date of receipt of the claim, which the Secretary has defined as an application or claim being an informal claim. And I would submit that based on the actual language of the statute and regulations and the definitions that the Secretary has provided, that an effective date of 1995 should be awarded.
Now, I can determine this from the record, I guess, by looking at the engagement letter that you filed, or your firm filed, to engage, to Mrs. Jernigan to engage you. Now, can you tell me now, in terms of the process, when your firm was engaged to represent her, and what at the regional office, at the board, where, in what point in the process?
I believe we entered at the court stage, Your Honor, if I'm not mistaken.
Okay.
Now, if you want an actual answer to that, I can certainly follow up.
I can tell that from the engagement.
I believe it was following the board decision after the appeal was filed before this court. Thank you very much.
Hang on.
Okay, the case is submitted. We'll brief counsel.
All rise.